We begin the first hour with a discussion of the Foreign Service. I was mentioning to my first guest just a moment ago that I have a lot of opportunity to cover the Department of Defense, and I have a lot of opportunity to talk about what is going on there and also at the Homeland Security Department, and not as much opportunity to talk about the Foreign Service. So it's a pleasure to welcome Ambassador Ronald Newman, who is president of the American Academy of Diplomacy and, of course, a long and distinguished career in the Foreign Service. And it's a pleasure to have you on the program, sir. Thanks for coming in
today.
Thanks
very much. Appreciate the opportunity to talk about a kind of forgotten aspect of the U.S. government.
You are also author of a book called The Other War, Winning and Losing in Afghanistan. And, of course, a lot of our attention right now is focused on Afghanistan. We'll talk about your experience there later on in the show and talk about the contents of this book, which are tremendously fascinating. Talk about, first, though, the American Academy of Diplomacy and the role that you play in interacting with the State Department and our efforts around the world.
Sure. We're a non-government organization. We have no U.S. government funding. We're slightly elitist or snobbish, if you prefer. We're a very small organization of people who have held very senior positions in the diplomatic service. Not all foreign service officers, but variety. And in fact, we put our members on inactive status when they go back into the government. Right now, the members on inactive status who've gone back in and answered the call to return to the government include Mark Grossman, the special envoy to Afghanistan, Ryan Crocker, who's going out, of course, as ambassador, Princeton Lyman, who's the special ambassador for the Sudan. So it's hard to keep our membership up sometimes when they keep going back into government. But its purpose is a strengthened diplomacy for the United States. That's the purpose of the organization. And aside from a very small office, the rest of the members give their time pro bono at no cost to work on various projects, lectures, and programs involved in furthering American diplomacy.
How did this develop to be such a passion for you? What led you into this field of interest?
The Academy or the Foreign Service?
Foreign Service.
Well, when I was growing up, my father was a university professor, and we had foreigners and American diplomats wandering through the house. And somewhere about the 10th grade, I decided this was what I wanted to do, and 11 years in a war later, I got into the Foreign Service.
Your career, as I mentioned, is extremely distinguished. It includes time as ambassador to Afghanistan, to Bahrain, and to Algeria. And that part of the world is in tremendous focus right now. And as I mentioned, we'll explore that later on in the program. One of the things about the Foreign Service that interests me is what leads people like yourself into it. Talk about where we stand today as far as attracting the next generation of Foreign Service officers and the kinds of people that are expressing interest in going into this field and what kinds of efforts it takes, if any, to get people to do it.
It's a very competitive field. I think there are probably many motivations that bring people in, but a combination of an interest in foreign affairs, a sense of adventure, and a desire to serve, I think, are all parts of it. I've known many who've come in after early careers in law and other things, which clearly paid better, but who felt that they wanted an opportunity to serve. Entry is by examination. It's very competitive when you drill down from the 15 or 16,000 a year that take the written exam to the numbers that come in. We're slightly more selective than Harvard. Mm. They take about 6% of their applicants. We take 4%.
Wow.
We have not had any problem getting people to apply because of the number of danger posts we have, which is not only Afghanistan, Iraq, and Pakistan. We have now about 18% of Foreign Service posts are in places considered too dangerous to allow families to go, including a number of countries in Africa and some other places. So we have a fair number of danger posts, and then, of course, much larger that have hardships for disease and difficult living conditions. This is not posed a recruitment problem. And I would say with younger officers, we have more volunteers for Afghanistan and Iraq than we have places to send them to.
That's fascinating because I would think it seems to me that most folks that you talk to who have an opinion about general perception of the rest of the world have a perception that most people in the United States are not terribly aware of what's going on in other parts of the world. Our media outlets around the country are cutting their bureaus in foreign countries and so forth.
Boy, is that true.
And so it seems that the awareness is going down at the same time that you're talking about the interest in people actually serving in these places is on the increase.
Well, you know, when you think of a population of 300 million and 15 or 16,000 take the exam, and some may self-select out after the written exam, I don't know whether it's changing much of the nation. I think we have always attracted people with a strong interest in foreign affairs. One of the big differences over the last 20 years or more is that it's no longer an elite profession. It's no longer a East Coast profession. It represents something fairly reasonably close to the geographic distribution in the United States, and a growing number of minorities, both Asian, Hispanic, as African-American. I don't think we classify women as a minority anymore, because I think about half of our incoming Foreign Service classes, plus or minus, have bid women for quite some time now.
When you see someone who is a candidate for Foreign Service, what aspects of their background or experience or personality or any of those causes you to say, this is a great candidate, this is somebody who I think will be very successful?
Well, they're all the things you would probably normally think of, like have they had any overseas experience, are they interested in foreign cultures, foreign languages. There's also the quality of people's ability to think. A great deal of actual work in foreign affairs is not the business of what should a policy be, but how do you make a policy work? It's wonderful to stand up and say we should support democracy. Now, what does that mean in an individual country? How do you make that work? How do you balance with other national interests? So obviously you don't expect people to know all that coming in, but one of the things you're looking for is their quality of mind, how they can think about issues like that.
Is it a critical thinking, or is it a logic, or is it a combination of those or other elements?
Well, as a practitioner, of course, I like to think that it's both critical thinking and logic. I don't know, others on the outside might have a different view, but I think it is a fairly sophisticated ability to deal with complexities. Often you will hear people say, we need to straighten out the priorities between X and Y, democracy and stability. Very rarely does a great nation like the United States have the luxury of having one absolute priority everywhere. Much more often the problem is, how do you advance multiple priorities that have some tensions between them, and in any particular case try to minimize the tensions and advance multiple interests? That's a more complex way of thinking about things, but I think also a more realistic one.
Ambassador Ronald Newman is my guest. He's president of the American Academy of Diplomacy, and we'll continue our conversation. Let's talk a little bit about your book in Afghanistan when we come back, since that's such a high-level priority for the government and for the Foreign Service right now. We'll do that when we continue on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Pentagon and Beyond, brought to you by Airink.
Why were the roads shut down around the Pentagon after last Friday's incident involving a Marine Corps Lance Corporal?
Based on the fact that he had fled from the Fort Myers Police Department, that he wasn't forthcoming with his information as far as identifiers and then just what he was doing, and he did have some products with him, that's why we felt that it was appropriate to close these roadways down.
U.S. Park Police spokesman David Slaughter. Jonathan Malaku claimed he had explosives. His car was found near the Pentagon. I'm J.J. Green.
Solar activity, which causes geomagnetic storms in space, can impact everything. From over-the-horizon radar, often used for aircraft and missile launches from a long distance away, to submarine detection systems, to two things we've come to rely on, our cell phones and GPS. Airink has developed a space environmental impact tool that advises, before it happens, what will be affected by bad weather in space. For more information and career opportunities, log on to arinc.com.
If sitting at a desk, working at a computer, or drinking coffee was a good workout, most of us would be in awesome shape. Unfortunately, they aren't. But that doesn't mean if you're behind a desk, you can't go move around some. Kaiser Permanente suggests organizing a lunchtime walking group. Nothing revolutionary, just a group of coworkers that walk every day at lunch. It doesn't matter where, what matters is the walking. Just 30 minutes a day. Studies show that employees who move around and get exercise feel less stressed, lose weight, and lower their risk for chronic conditions. When employers choose Kaiser Permanente, the walking group is just one of the many ideas and tools that we provide to help employees stay healthier and more productive. Find out how a Kaiser Permanente plan can help your employees and your business thrive. Go to kp.org/thrive9to5.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
Do you know us? We employ more than 70,000 people in more than 800 locations throughout the United States. Through our network of suppliers, we indirectly enable tens of thousands of American jobs. Tens of thousands. Jobs that put food on the table. Jobs that put kids through college. Jobs that keep our economy going. And yet, many of you don't even know who we are. Our name is United Technologies. We are Carrier, Hamilton Sunstrand, Otis, Pratt & Whitney, Sikorsky, and UTC Fire and Security. Six businesses united as one powerful company. We may be the biggest unknown company in America, but our jobs power the economy. And our technologies, products, and services power the world. United Technologies. Get to know more about us at UTC.com.
I'm Amy Morris. Here's a look at Tuesday morning's Federal Drive. Federal agencies are working together to keep counterfeit items out of the supply chain. We'll learn more about Operation Chain Reaction. And we'll introduce you to our Causey Award winners, highlighting the human capital management field within the federal government and industry. That and more Tuesday morning, starting at 6 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. For all the latest federal news, check us out on federalnewsradio.com.
Headed to Fort Detrick or the I-270 Technology Corridor, Federal News Radio can be heard crystal clear on 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland. It's the same great station, just on an added frequency. Get the latest news about the federal government and government contractors. Hear exclusive interviews with the movers and shakers in the federal arena. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM or 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland. Federal News Radio, your source for federal news now.
Back on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Ambassador Ronald Newman is my guest. He is president of the American Academy of Diplomacy and, among other posts, during his foreign service career, he served as ambassador to Afghanistan from 2005 to 2007. Is that correct,
sir? I came there straight from 16 months in Iraq, so Afghanistan was my reward for Iraq.
You must have done a fine job in Iraq then.
That's right.
Well, someone who's making that same transition, or in the process of making that transition, is Ambassador Crocker. We talked about him a little bit during the break in between our segments. And I mentioned that as I listened to his confirmation hearing, I was gratified to hear that there is still some bipartisanship, some chivalry left in Washington, because the members of the committee were unanimous, both sides of the aisle, praising him and thanking him for being willing to come back and serve again. You mentioned you've known him quite a long time.
We met first in Iran in 1974, 1975. He was vice consul in Khorramshahr, and I was a consul in Tabriz at opposite ends of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And, we've known each other ever since.
He's headed to a country, barring some wildly unpredictable scenario, that you're very familiar with. And you've written this book called The Other War, Winning and Losing in Afghanistan. What do you think most people, even maybe in the diplomatic community, don't understand about what either what we're doing in Afghanistan or about the country itself or the culture itself?
I think many people have an impression First of all, that it never was a country, which is not true. It has rather long history. Many people think it was never at peace. That's not true. I first visited in 1967. One peculiar distinction I have of no particular historical importance is that my father was also ambassador in Afghanistan. It's only happened twice in our diplomatic history. And my wife and I went out in 1967, traveled all over the country by jeep, by horse, even in my case by yacht, and really saw a great deal of the country. And it was a very peaceful place. My wife and I drove from one side of the country to the other 5 days, 36 passes, all dirt roads, 7 river fords, one American engineer with us, one Afghan engineer, a couple of drivers. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was that peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think people have that. Have a conception that it's never been peaceful or been organized. I think there is a huge job there. You're trying to help people rebuild after 30 years of war and foreign invasion and warlords. It's very difficult for Americans, I think, to understand what that does to a country, traumatizes population. And therefore, in many ways, how slow it is to help rebuilding. People don't just snap out of 30 years of trauma.
Mm-hmm. You talk about an Afghanistan that is unknown to an entire generation of people there, let alone people in this country. But there still is a generation of people there who remembers the Afghanistan of 30 to 48 years ago and before. Why do you think it has been difficult for them to call people's attention to their own history?
In the case of Afghans, part of it is the total breakdown of their educational system. When we went into Afghanistan in 2001, there were only about 900,000 students in school out of a population of roughly 28 million. And all of them were boys because, of course, the Taliban wouldn't let girls go to school.
Mm-hmm.
There are now about 7 million students in schools. That's a 700 times expansion, or sevenfold expansion, sorry. And about a third of those are now girls. But that means there's also an interruption in teaching people about history.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw an article the other day about how few Americans properly understand the U.S. Constitution.
Yeah.
And yet we have an ongoing educational system. So if you pull people out and they have no education, mm-hmm. how much less do they understand about their own past?
What do you see in what people in the United States understand about Afghanistan that is different or incomplete compared to the reality that you know from being in the country?
The hardest thing I know to get across is to explain that out of the 10 years we've been at war, we've only been doing what we needed to do for about 2.5 of them. And so people will say to you over and over again, well, you've done it 10 years. Obviously, it doesn't work. Why don't you understand that? You know, sometimes I've said in frustration, I could make pancakes for 10 years, and if I never put the eggs in, I'd never get them to rise. if you don't put in the right elements, you don't get the right outcome. Now, I think President Obama made some very important, correct decisions, some that I agree with less with, and the strategy is beginning to work. I was back in Afghanistan in March this mm-hmm. year, and there is some real improvement in some areas. There's a lot that still has to be tested. I think people need to understand that it's really the year ahead of us where we will test the strategy of being able to turn over significant areas, difficult areas, to the Afghans.
Mm-hmm.
That's the time that will prove whether the strategy is working. I think the hardest thing is to get Americans to cool their jets a little bit and understand that you don't have the information base to make some of the judgments people want to make, but there are some reasons for hope.
Mm-hmm. If we think about it through the lens of your hypothesis, which is that really the last 2.5 years have been the productive years as far as the military operation and then the support operations there as well, it does make it seem a bit more tolerable, I will say. It certainly doesn't diminish the losses that the families have felt of the military people who have served, and the foreign service officers have lost their lives too as well, and the contracting community too. But talk about thinking about it from that point of view. And thinking about it from, especially in context of what we're seeing some news reports, that apparently there are discussions with the Taliban, and yet there's a school of thought, I know, within the defense community that kind of harkens back to what you talked about as being not the most accurate, which is this is country's always going to be a tribal country. A central government's not going to work in this country, and we should just do what we can to try to keep the problems there tamped down as much as possible, rather than go for what I imagine the ultimate goal at least was early on, which is some type of a representative form of government where people would have a voice in their own destiny.
I think that's important, but I think one needs to step back from it. In a country that is fractured, if you want to keep people from, like the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, from coming back, you will have to have some form of government for which people will fight. And that requires a certain amount of participation in order to have the loyalty that gets people to fight for their country. Whether it has to be exactly a democracy, I think, is not quite so clear, and you can get certainly carried away with our forms and procedures, but you have to have a certain amount of popular support. I do think it's hard for Americans to understand how much this was the other war. The title I gave the book, while Iraq was still going strong, just to give you sort of a sense of this, in 2005, late in 2005, I could see the war was going to get much worse, and so could a lot of others. This was not genius. And I asked for a $600 million supplemental for economic support for the next year. And after 3 or 4 months of discussion in the administration, out of $600 million I started off asking for, I got 43.
Not quite what you had hoped for.
Not quite what I had hoped for. Less than a nickel on the dollar, actually. By the next year, when we understood things were getting worse, there was a big economic supplemental just as I was leaving the country. But then you have time lags. You ask for money in February. You decide in the fall of the previous year. You ask in February. Congress votes in the summer. Money gets to the field late summer to fall. By the time you've signed contracts, you're into winter. If you're building a road or something, you can't even do it. So the first time an Afghan will see dirt turn for a road that you decided to build in 2006 will be the spring of 2008. And that's not because anybody has really messed up. That's our constitutional system that preserves the power of Congress and preserves us as a free people. But there are big time lags like that built in, and I think people often confuse a decision being made with something happening on the ground, and often the something may be a year later.
Ambassador Ronald Newman is my guest. He's the president of the American Academy of Diplomacy, and he's author of the book that he referred to called The Other War, Winning and Losing in Afghanistan. We'll put some information up about how you can learn more about the book at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, and I'll continue my conversation with Ambassador Newman in just a moment.
The Federal Drive is every weekday from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 a.m. Hear interviews, news, perspective, and analysis from Tom Temin and Amy Morris. The Federal Drive team will help give you the important information you need about the federal government and how it impacts your organization or agency. Tune in 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. or go to federalnewsradio.com. The Federal Drive is sponsored by CDWG. CDWG, the people who get it.
Concerned about your health? Then be sure to catch the groundbreaking radio show Essentials of Healthy Living, brought to you by Village Green Apothecary. Join hosts Dana Lake and Kevin Facero as they bring you the latest news about traditional and alternative medicine, nutrition, dietary supplements, herbal remedies, and more. Tune in every Sunday at 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio. Listen to past shows and discover other healthy living resources at myvillagegreen.com. Visit Village Green Apothecary in Bethesda at 5415 West Cedar Lane.
It's the only program of its kind in the world. A unique opportunity to help strengthen our country's defense and further your career. The National Defense Executive MBA at George Mason University's School of Management. The only executive MBA degree tailored to developing leaders and managers in the U.S. defense industry. A unique combination of high-caliber executive business education, defense industry-specific knowledge, and hands-on learning designed to accelerate your career in the military, government, and corporate defense sectors. All without the career interruption of a traditional degree. Learn more at som.gmu.edu/defense. That's som.gmu.edu/defense. Do it today because the last day to apply for the fall semester is July 15th. The National Defense Executive MBA at George Mason University, helping our country's defense, advancing your career.
Vacation time is just around the corner. Ready to go? Since 1967, Ackerman Security has been keeping families like yours safe and secure. For just $18.95 a month, you can trust in the protection of Ackerman's nationally certified monitoring center. Ackerman offers the latest technology like cell phone control, wireless monitoring, and remote video to your web-enabled phone, iPad, or laptop. Federal government employees get an added bonus. 4 months of monitoring free. Call 888-999-1070 or AckermanSecurity.com.
The possibility of an invisibility cloak is a step closer to reality. Engineers are now able to fabricate large pieces of a material with very unique properties. Engineers like John Rogers at the University of Illinois are creating so-called metamaterials, structured to play tricks with light.
The hope is that you could engineer a material like that to bend light in such a way that it sort of moves around an object and creates a level of invisibility.
Until now, those structures have been vanishingly small themselves, but Rogers has devised a way to print large sheets of a promising metamaterial
so that you can create enough of it that you can begin to think about engineering applications of these structures.
Rogers says more work is needed for an invisibility cloak, but this new printing method may already allow advances in communication and imaging systems. For more, go to www.nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The Performance Improvement Council, in partnership with the Department of Defense, would like to invite all federal employees to this year's Performance Symposium in Lansdowne, Virginia, June 27th through the 30th. The symposium will feature sessions led by leaders from across the federal government. Focus areas include performance, strategy, budget, and more. Spots are filling up fast. Please go to live.i6sigma.com to register with the code FEDERAL2011 or email info@pic.gov for more information.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest is Ambassador Ronald Newman. He is president of the American Academy of Diplomacy and has served as ambassador to such calm, peaceful outposts as Afghanistan, Iraq, Bahrain, Algeria, and a number of others. And I'm grateful for your time in the studio today. He's author of the book, The Other War, Winning and Losing in Afghanistan. And I mentioned we'll put some information about how people can learn more about your book at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Happy to do it. I have played a number of highlights of hearings of the Commission on Wartime Contracting in Iraq and Afghanistan over the past 2 years or so, and talked to a number of the members of the commission on the air, as we have on the morning show here on the Federal Drive as well. One of the issues that they're most concerned about is the transition from military to civilian oversight of our mission, of our operations in Iraq. If we continue on the timeline that the president has outlined in Afghanistan, it won't be long until we're looking at the same kind of transition there, where we'll have a primarily civilian presence rather than a primarily military presence. What are your thoughts about some of the challenges that we're facing and that the Foreign Service officers will be dealing with in each of those countries as that transition takes place?
Several different ones. In Iraq, of course, there's the problem. There's a double problem. One is that you need a lot of money to stand up the physical facilities and some of the protection that the military has provided. These are functions the State Department has never undertaken.
Mm-hmm.
The second problem is the continuing budget fight, not just the problem of not having the money and therefore perhaps not being able to do the job at all, but with the continuing resolutions, they haven't been able to plan or budget properly because they don't know how much money they'll have. So even if they are funded to do what they're supposed to do, they will almost certainly be slow and late getting it done because mm-hmm. they can't start in a timely fashion.
Right.
There's a larger problem behind that when you talk about moving from, say, what they would call stabilization to reconstruction development. And that is that aid is a fundamentally crippled organization because of how small, because of the size to which it has been reduced. It's roughly just a little over 10% of what it was when I first visited Afghanistan. We have fewer people in AID worldwide than we had in AID in Vietnam alone,
mm-hmm.
give you a sense of magnitude. Mm-hmm. They have 10, a new study just came out. One of the things it points out is they have something like 10 contracting officers total.
In the entire agency?
In Afghanistan.
I see.
The number they figure they need in Afghanistan alone exceeds the number they have in the agency.
Mm-hmm.
The military has lots, and it's an important thing. If you want to supervise contracts, you need contracting officers. You need people to get out and see what they're doing. Aid hasn't been permitted to have that kind of strength. Second thing is contractors are hired to do the contract you hire them to do. They're not hired to tell you you hired them to do the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you need professionals in the middle of the action mm-hmm. to do. It's much harder to determine that when you're three steps removed from the contract.
Yeah.
And if you're talking 20-year development projects, that's not so important. But when you're trying to tie development into a war, if you cripple your development agency on its personnel side, then, yes, you will have a lot of problems with contractors. But we don't fix the underlying problem, which is aid's ability to supervise them. We just keep trying to fix individual contracts, and then we're surprised when the problem reoccurs.
Mm-hmm. The whole issue of the contracting of some of these projects that we've seen, and we've heard about the horror stories from Iraq, it doesn't strike me that that's a fair representation of the work that's gone on in the country, and the same thing in Afghanistan, I imagine.
It's not in some respects. I don't want to be too defensive here, but we have done, I think, a lot of good work as well. There is a tension between long-term development and the kind of things you do to put people back to work quickly and keep them from shooting at you, which doesn't always have long-term work.
Mm-hmm.
That sometimes gets criticized for not having the longer-term tail on it. But the other piece is, both in Afghanistan and in Iraq, we jumped into situations where there was no opportunity for real serious long-term development planning. In Iraq, we didn't know we were going to do that kind of a war. Some people tried to say that might be necessary, but they were not listened to. And in Afghanistan, of course, we had no intention of fighting there at all until 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
So when you jump in like that, you're always going to be deficient on planning because you don't have the option to say, well, just sit here and be miserable for 2 or 3 years till I get my planning done and I'll come back.
Right.
So you start and then you learn and then you adjust. And some of the adjustments will have wasted effort. On the whole, I think we've actually contributed a great deal in Afghanistan, where I'm more intimately familiar with the effort, with hundreds of miles of road. And when I left, we had done 500 schools and 500 clinics alone just with our aid program, and there were a lot of other people working in the area. A lot of issues like electricity that are complex, but Kabul does have lights now, and it was dark when I was there. But these things take a while as well, and there's lots of room for finger-pointing.
Ambassador Ronald Newman, my guest, he's president of the American Academy of Diplomacy. You alluded to security as an issue for the civilian personnel who are in countries like Iraq and Afghanistan. I want to ask you a little bit more about that when we come back from the break on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We'll continue in just a moment.
Radio, I'm Kelly O'Donnell. Justices at the Supreme Court have turned back the largest class action suit in history, ruling in favor of Walmart and against more than 1 million women who claim sex discrimination. NBC's justice correspondent, Pete Williams.
They said there wasn't enough glue in this class action to hold all the members of the class together. They said there has to be something in common that caused the discrimination for each member of the class.
President Obama could announce within days how quickly he wants to start withdrawing troops from Afghanistan, even as peace talks continue with some leaders. Tropical storm Beatriz is threatening the south central coast of Mexico with sustained winds of 60 miles an hour. It's expected to reach hurricane strength before making landfall tonight or tomorrow. And Americans are giving again. After 2 years of diminished donations, charitable contributions rose again in 2010 to a total of $291 billion. I'm Kelly O'Donnell, NBC News Radio.
Could switching to Geico really save you 15% or more on car insurance? Is texting getting way out of hand? You know, I can't... Oh, please. Oh, that is funny. Where was I? Oh, yes, about texting. Pardon me. LOL, you are my BFF. So, like I was saying...
Switch to Geico now and you could save hundreds on your car insurance. For a free rate quote, visit geico.com to see how much you could save. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
If you want to sell your car the fast and easy way, just bring it into CarMax today. CarMax will appraise your car and give you a written offer that's good for 7 days, so you can think it over or sell it right away. And the best part is, CarMax will buy your car even if you don't buy one of ours. So skip the hassle. Sell your car the easy way by bringing it into CarMax today. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
This is NIH Health Matters. I'm Joe Belinfi. Researchers have established that the tumor suppressor gene called P53, which deals with chromosome or DNA damage and determines whether cells are going to grow or survive after DNA damage, can also control the innate immune system, the body's basic response to threats.
And what we think is that that may enhance the ability in some way to deal with infections or bacterial infections or viral infections.
Dr. Michael Resnick, a principal investigator at the National Institutes of Health, says humans evolved an inflammatory response when subjected to DNA damage. For more information on the link between DNA damage and the immune system, visit www.niehs.nih.gov. Health Matters is produced by the National Institutes of Health, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
See more, do more, get more. HP notebook PCs powered by Vision Pro technology from AMD simply deliver more. Graphics made incredible, multitasking made easy, high performance made possible. Designed with HP mobile innovations that let productivity happen anywhere, anytime. Notebooks built to handle big demands. Price so your budget can handle it. Give your agency the power of HP and AMD. To find out how, go to hp.com/go/perform.
Newsmakers on In Depth with Francis Rose.
Gene Sexton is the Deputy Chief Human Capital Officer at the Labor Department.
Getting away from those KSA essays, which that was the hard part, has taken the whole hiring process from a writing exercise with reams of paper to one where you have verifiable data, such as resumes and transcripts and other types of documentation that can be verified or not verified. And you get a more quality recruit when you can have that kind of documentation.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest is Ambassador Ronald Newman. He's president of the American Academy of Diplomacy. He is a former ambassador to Afghanistan, among other positions, and has written a book called The Other War, Winning and Losing in Afghanistan. And we've talked about a number of the challenges that that country is facing and that our Foreign Service is facing in dealing with what's going on in Afghanistan. One of the issues is just personal security and the safety of the people who are deployed there. And it's something that you dealt with as well in Iraq. We've heard some of the horror stories about situations with security in those countries and some of the contractors that have been involved there. And there's been this, it seems to me, kind of an evolution of two schools of thought when it comes to that. One of the schools of thought is that the State Department should have a cadre of security officers, almost of military capability, almost like an MP force, I guess, to protect the Foreign Service officers that are in country. The other school of thought is that if security is that badly deteriorated, that Foreign Service officers shouldn't be there, or at least only the absolutely necessary people should be there. Is that even the right discussion to have? Is that the right? Are those the right options? Are those the only options there, or is there some other theory that you believe that's not even there?
I don't think they can be the only options. The old theory was if it's too dangerous, you shouldn't be there. Trouble is, it doesn't fit the world.
Mm-hmm.
When I first came in the Foreign Service and I was serving in places like Iran, we had terrorist threats. We had four Americans assassinated over the 3 years that I was in Iran, one successful assassination every year. We had much lower security presence then. But as the terrorism problem has built, that's already forced us to have higher measures of security in a great many countries of the world. People forget that we've had our diplomats killed in Kenya and Tanzania. Around the world, we've had diplomats killed. Secondly, when you get to a place like Afghanistan, the business of how do you sell programs to foreigners, how do you get their buy-in, how do you produce long-term social change, these are the skill sets that the Foreign Service and aid professionals bring to the business. And when we're at war, as we are, I don't think you can just say, I don't want to take those people. Let the military do it. For one thing, it's not a prime skill set of the military. They don't actually do it as well as we do. And secondly, it's wrong to ask them to do it, because what you're doing is adding one more mission and one more issue to stretch an already stretched force. Where are they going to find the people to do it?
Mm-hmm.
So, if you need the mission done, which the country does, then you ought to use the right people to do it, which is us.
Mm-hmm.
Or I say us, although I'm retired now. And
you still count.
If you're going to use, I'll say us, then you're going to have to deal with security. Now, Iraq is posing a super problem because we have never tried to secure ourselves separately from the military in an operation that big. But a lot of that security is up in the area between the Kurdish and Arab zones. That's the area that has the most risk for accidental conflict turning into a war and destroying everything that the surge and the sacrifice of the military has built. So there's a mood I don't understand in the Congress that says the military can do it, and if they could stay, that's okay, but if they go away, I don't want to fund it, and let's let it all go to hell. This just makes no sense to me. You're going to have to protect the civilians to do it if that's the only option you got.
What does the ideal, in your view, model for protecting the civilians in the Foreign Service look like in environments like Afghanistan and Iraq?
Well, it's got a couple of different pieces. We're probably always going to need some level of contractors because we're not going to have enough people to do it all ourselves. But we also need to re-examine the issue of risk. Sometimes we are too restrictive. I know a lot of Foreign Service officers that voluntarily push the envelope of risk in order to get their job done. They shouldn't have to risk their career as well. I don't mean they should be military. They're not. But we shouldn't keep them so bottled up, or require them to be so bottled up, that they can't do their job either.
Mm-hmm.
And finding that balance is very hard. It's dangerous. I've had friends killed. My convoy was blown up in Afghanistan. One of my guards lost his leg. I was already in the hospital with disease, so they were just coming to pick me up. But, for those who think this is a safe profession of striped pants, cookie pushers, sipping cocktails, I've got a lot of friends who spent a lot of time with dirty boots, and mm-hmm. they're still diplomats. You got to find the balance. You got to find it at a very high level of detail that's going to be very situation specific. But that means that Washington also has to be willing to take that. You can't have a security paradigm that sort of like the librarian who's only happy when all the books are on the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
People have got to get out a little bit, but you got to find the right balance. Mm-hmm. Books have to come back to the shelf, too.
That's right. Ambassador Ronald Newman's my guest. He's president of the American Academy of Diplomacy. We don't do much. We're not looking to cast blame or assign whatever. But when we come back, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the lessons that we've learned in these two countries that we've talked about primarily, Iraq and Afghanistan. particularly when it comes to you and your colleagues in Foreign Service, and what we take away and try to apply the next time we're in a sticky situation like this. We'll do that when we come back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's In Depth with Francis Rose.
Do you know us? You count on our technology every day. The office elevator that takes you up and down efficiently. The jet engine that gets you home safely. The fire suppression system you hope you never need, but know is there. You count on things we make to protect you from harm, and even to keep you cool and comfortable. Our technologies are a critical part of your everyday life. Yet many people don't even know who we are. Our name is United Technologies. We are Carrier, Hamilton Sunstrand, Otis, Pratt & Whitney, Sikorsky, and UTC Fire and Security. Six businesses united as one powerful company. In fact, we are one of the largest manufacturers in the United States, which likely makes us the biggest company you've never heard of, even though you depend on us every single day. United Technologies. Get to know more about us at UTC.com.
Meeting mission goals through technology, brought to you by General Dynamics Information Technology.
The Agriculture Department's Rural Utilities Service is issuing $250 million in low-interest loans to help smaller rural electric providers add technology to their local power grids. USDA says the loans to implement smart grid technology will help bring about innovative features like customized real-time electric usage monitoring to homes and businesses throughout America through smart electric meters. And technological improvements to the grid itself will decrease the number of blackouts.
General Dynamics Information Technology is dedicated to providing the latest, highest quality information technology services and resources to help organizations meet their mission objectives. Large-scale IT systems and communications networks are the strategic and operational heart of defense, intelligence, civilian government, and private business. They require the expertise of a company that delivers results. General Dynamics Information Technology. Information technology and professional services. Go to GDIT.com to learn more. That's GDIT.com.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth, every Saturday at 10 a.m. here on Federal News Radio. Join me this week when my special guest will be David McGilvery, Action Coach. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman, a full-service law firm located in Fairfax, Virginia, serving the entire D.C. metro area. If you want to know more about OF&P, visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.
Celebrate summer and support the Boys and Girls Clubs at Safeway's Barbecue Battle, June 25th and 26th on Pennsylvania Avenue. This great family event features the nation's best barbecue, along with 30 great rock, R&B, and blues bands, plenty of free food samples, celebrity chefs, contests, prizes, and more. Easy to get to by Metro. Call 202-828-3099 or visit bbqdc.com. See you at the barbecue.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest is Ambassador Ronald Newman. He's the president of the American Academy of Diplomacy and author of the book, The Other War, Winning and Losing in Afghanistan. And we've talked a fair amount about Afghanistan and Iraq on the program today. As operations change in Iraq and we head toward the same kind of change in Afghanistan, I imagine this is the time in Washington where people start to think about the next time. And as you consider the things that you've seen in each of those countries, what about next time? What lessons do you take away from each of these situations in each of these countries for next time?
First thing I take away is a lesson that many people won't like. There will be a next time. Many people would like to take away the lesson that we just shouldn't have a next time. They might even be right. It's just irrelevant. When you look back, every administration in the last 30 years has had interventions. Panama, Grenada, Haiti, Iraq, war, Bush, on and on. So I think it's simply reasonable to suppose that we will do interventions again, wise or not so wise. Secondly, my takeaways are, since it will happen again, let's at least have the flexible and material resources to start. You'll always have to go back to Congress. Every situation will be different. But We've been trying to set up a contingency stabilization group in State Department, not terribly large. It's still only half funded. Don't stop that. Don't walk away and forget that. Aid needs an organization that can handle its work, and there needs to be some, perhaps small pot of money, perhaps deployed with congressional assent, but something that is available in a crisis. Because we go in, and outside the military, we find ourselves without the personnel, without the authorities, without the resources, and then it takes us a very long time in our constitutional system to acquire those things. We have no rapid way of getting them. So since we've done interventions for 60 years and stabilization, maybe this time we should get smart enough to have a residual left over for the next time.
Sounds like you're just advocating the old Boy Scout motto, which is be prepared.
Uh-huh. It worked pretty well for them, too.
I am very grateful for your time today, Ambassador. It's been wonderful to have you in studio.
It's been my pleasure.
I have a long list of things here to cover and no time to do it, so I'd like to invite you to come back and talk with me again.
I'd be delighted. Thank you very much.
Happy to do it. Ambassador Ronald Newman's been my guest for the hour. He's the president of the American Academy of Diplomacy, and you can hear our conversation at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. It'll be posted there so you can hear the whole thing.